we're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
From the Center for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Natasha Moore. Even if we claim not to, most of us usually prefer for things to be a bit black and white. We want to feel like we're on the side of truth and justice. Arrayed against us on the other side of whatever issue are people who can only be stupid or possibly just bad people. But of course, stuff is complicated. And there are plenty of people out there who have signed up for the often thankless but important job of complicating everything. A lot of them are academics. They're the people who tend to stick their hand up when things are reported in the media and say, "Excuse me, I think you'll find that this issue is a bit more complicated than that." But that doesn't mean they're always immune to black and white thinking themselves. Today's episode is a conversation with Tom Echner, a sociologist and scholar of religion. He lectures in science and religion at the University of Queensland. And I sat down with him to talk about the old science versus religion chestnut, Galileo, Darwin, why people believe or disbelieve things, and how academics from different disciplines should probably talk to each other more. I started off by asking him how popular this idea still is, that science and religion are enemies, or at least not friends.
Well, I think it's a pretty widespread notion. We see it coming up a lot in popular media, in the press. There are a lot of popular philosophers and scientists that are saying that essentially, because of what they are, religion and science must be in conflict, that they compete for explanatory territory. And because of this, they've always been in conflict from the very beginning of when we get this thing called science, and they will remain in conflict until, in their minds, hopefully, science wins.
Who doesn't think that?
Well, the people that don't accept the conflict thesis, or it's also called the warfare model, have really been other academics. And it really began with historians several decades ago. And these historians started to question these ideas that science and religion have always been in conflict. And they started to look at the empirical data that we have regarding the interactions between science and religion throughout history. And they found that actually it wasn't the case that they've always been in conflict. They haven't always been friends, but they often have not been in conflict. Sometimes religion has been an impetus and helped promote ideas of science. Other times scientific ideas have been hard for religious people to accept, but often they just got along and they weren't necessarily interacting with each other in a problematic way. And this idea, which has really been attributed to a guy named John Brooke from the University of Oxford, was called the complexity thesis. And that was the way that scholars have really come to describe the relationships between science and religion. It's definitely not one of historical antagonism all of the time, but it's also definitely not one of everyone being friends all of the time. It's just a lot more nuanced and complex.
I've heard this referred to as the conflict myth. Would you put it that strongly?
Yeah, I would say that it is certainly a popular myth, and that there just isn't evidence for the idea that since the beginning of what we call the advancement of science from the scientific revolution onwards, that science has been in conflict with religion. There just is not evidence for it. And so in that sense, it is a myth, and it's a powerful myth that seems to have got hold of people's minds despite the reality that there just isn't evidence for it.
There are a couple of key stories this myth really crystallizes around. The biggies will be familiar to you, Galileo and evolution. I asked Tom to walk us through these two cases, why those are maybe not such clear-cut examples, after all, of a clash between science and religion.
Galileo is the case that's still brought up. I've heard it brought up by very senior academics within the last year or so at popular public events. And the problem is that it is effectively still not really a science and religion conflict. There were aspects of science involved, there were aspects of religion involved, but in many ways, a lot of historians have said it actually comes down to being a science versus science conflict. Some of the biggest supporters of Galileo were priests, but there just wasn't scientific evidence within that time period, empirical evidence to support some of the things that Galileo was saying. And to be honest, some of the things that Galileo was saying were wrong. So he thought, for instance, that the tides were caused by the motion, the spinning of the earth, and we know that that's not the case. And sort of as the water would be sort of sloshing around in a bucket if you moved a bucket around. And so some of the things that Galileo said were wrong, and they weren't really backed up by the science of that time. At the same time, there were political things happening. So at the, around the time of Galileo, the Roman Catholic Church was dealing with the Reformation, and they were trying to consolidate power, political power as well as religious power, and here is an individual that's questioning the Pope and putting the words of the Pope into a character essentially called Simplicio, meaning basically the idiot. And the Catholic Church didn't really take that very well. And also most historians say that Galileo, as it turned out, was not always the easiest guy to get along with. And so when he was putting forward his ideas, he was putting them forward in such a way that was purposefully irritating people. But it's still, it's when we get down to it, it's too simplistic to say that this is a science versus religion conflict. It just, we know that that's not the case. It's just much more complex than the black and white narrative.
What about evolution?
Evolution is another one of these interesting narratives. And part of the reason that people still point to evolution as being an exemplar of science and religion conflict is because there are people that are religiously motivated anti-evolutionists. There are people that question Darwinism and question evolutionary theory based on seemingly religious grounds. And so there is some validity to the fact that there is a point in which if you're not, that you will not accept science if you accept certain things religiously. But in terms of the Darwinian revolution, so when we get the publication of Charles Darwin's Origin of Species in the 19th century, it's also kind of a common narrative that all of the religious people were opposed to Darwin's view, that they were essentially young earth creationists, they believed in a young earth and a young universe, and Darwin was kind of this stalwart atheist scientist that was opposing them, and we know that also that's not true. Some of the leading supporters of Darwin were churchmen. And much of the original opposition to Darwin was based on, again, on scientific grounds. People did not believe that the theory of natural selection had empirical basis. In fact, that's why, following Darwin towards the end of the 19th century, natural selection actually fell off the map scientifically because people didn't think there was enough empirical evidence for it. And when there was opposition to Darwin kind of on more moral, religious grounds, it was on this fear that Darwin would reduce human value, and then we would all start killing each other, or we would all start treating each other like beasts. And so those were kind of the conflicts. But so there was definitely a science, again, a science versus science or an inter-science kind of debate about Darwin, and it wasn't clear-cut that these people were just opposed on purely reading, let's say, the book of Genesis literally, because at that time, many people did not accept that the book of Genesis was a literal text within, let's say, the English church.
So why does this myth, why does this story persist so strongly, do you think, if it's been, you know, so decisively shown to be much more complicated than that?
That's a question that people are still asking now. So, for instance, there are actual research projects that have been trying to answer this question. Why is this myth so persuasive? And there are a number of reasons. One of the reasons that I've been looking into is that it's in part and parcel of it's the genesis narratives of some research fields, actually. If you go back to the founders of sociology, the founders of anthropology, the founders of psychology, they were saying this, and this was picked up across different disciplines, and it was also really promoted by Andrew Dixon White and Draper, who wrote books on the history of science and religion. They said, look, essentially this is how it looks. When you get science and religion, or Christianity and science together, there is this conflict. So there's this history to this narrative that's become part of kind of popular views of science and religion. And it's at the same time, it's perpetuated, right? So it's been perpetuated by popular pundits who have keep advancing this idea despite now the empirical evidence that we have against it. And at the same time, there is conflict going on. We could find people that are opposed to scientific ideas because of religious premises. And we can find people that oppose religious ideas because of so-called scientific ideas or interpretations of scientific. So we do see that happening, but this narrative goes back for generations, for decades and decades and decades, and it's kind of become imbued as a popular sort of myth that we're all kind of sharing with each other.
The thing about a popular myth is that it takes on a life of its own. It's much easier to perpetuate it than to challenge it. A kind of side project Tom got interested in a few years back was to do with undergraduate science textbooks. This is one of those academic research projects that sounds like it could be a tad dry, but actually I've read his paper on this and it really helps pinpoint where the conflict model of science and religion is continuing to get oxygen from, including which disciplines are the worst offenders.
I got interested in this one several years ago. I was teaching a course in Canada on science and religion. Essentially, the course spent half the semester looking at the historical interactions between science and religion, going back to Galileo and the Scientific Revolution, and then the second half of the course looked at modern ideas of science and religion interaction, including creationism and intelligent design movement. And as I was, and the course was really set up to kind of teach this complexity. Say, look, when we look at the history of science and religion, we see this complexity. We see this complexity thesis through and through. And at least one student came to my office and said, you know, what you're teaching runs against what I'm learning in another class. I said, really? And it had to do with Galileo, the idea that Galileo was actually imprisoned, which is not true. I've heard from another student that Galileo was beheaded. Anyway, these ideas...
It should be easy to check.
Yeah, it should be easy to check. But a number of students were saying, look, what you're teaching is going against what I'm learning in the syllabus of other courses. And I asked, well, what courses are those? And at that time, it was anthropology. So that's actually what got me interested. And so eventually, when I had the time, I went back to, and I started looking at anthropology textbooks, modern 21st century anthropology textbooks. And lo and behold, I found significant myths about religion and science history. Those being, for instance, that narrative about Galileo, but the Galileo affair being the really first clash between science and religion. And that clash now has continued in perpetuity. And these were the sorts of myths that came out. The idea that the secularization thesis, that there is a clear reciprocal link between an increase in science in a society and a decrease in religion. So there's this idea that this is a very popular idea. And it's still propagated by many people. The idea that, well, once we learn how to be scientific, we'll stop being religious. And sociological evidence, for instance, does not actually back that up. And with sociologists that backed that up. So then I started looking at sociology textbooks. And they were also propagating many of these same myths. And it was from there that I started looking at biology textbooks and physics textbooks and psychology textbooks. And I started looking at a number of other textbooks. And I found that we still see these science and religion myths being propagated, not just by in the popular press, but actually on university campuses nowadays in 21st century textbooks published by some of the leading presses in the world today.
So what did you tell that student?
Oh, I told that student that their professor was incorrect.
How did that go down?
Oh, she walked out, I think. Shell-shocked.
So is there a sense here that, you know, undergraduate textbooks are dealing with things in quite an overview way and therefore superficially, and some of the things you're talking about are quite complex, and, you know, a lot of undergraduate subjects, if you go on to study further in that subject, people will say to you, oh, everything we taught you before was wrong, like it was just provisional because it was too complicated for you. Is that the case here?
So that was a question that I asked. I said, is this phenomenon, is this idea of what we're seeing, this fact that we're seeing science and religion myths being propagated in textbooks, is that a result of the genre constraints of textbooks themselves? So you have to, with textbooks, you're just throwing out so much information, you can't get into everything in depth. Is that actually what we're seeing? And what I found is that you actually do see textbooks in other fields. So I would say anthropology and sociology, in many ways, are the worst perpetrators. But we do see science textbooks, we see biology textbooks and physics textbooks, we see a lot of philosophy textbooks that are able to actually say to students very quickly and very concisely, actually, this is the Galileo affair. It's much more complicated because of A, B, C, and D. And then they give references. So what I found is that it's not a genre constraint. It might be a byproduct of publishing textbooks, because textbooks aren't necessarily peer-reviewed in the same way as other academic work. It could be that, but what I have found is that there are a number of textbooks that do it quite well. They say, look, actually, here are multiple ways that religion and science have gotten along in the past. And they'll actually say, look, there's a conflict idea. It actually turns out to be not that accurate. And then they'll give three or four other views on potential relationships between science and religion. So they're able to do that concisely and quickly. And this is from science to philosophy. So science and humanities, you can actually find textbooks that are doing it well, even within anthropology and sociology. So it's not just a constraint of textbooks. What I have found is that I think it's a result of the beliefs of those textbook writers, and they're not doing due diligence in actually accurately fact-checking the claims that they're making. In fact, there was a point where in anthropology and sociology textbooks, I actually found, I started checking the references. So I said, oh, look, they're making claims about Galileo. Oh, here's a reference to an historian. And I looked up the historian, and the historian actually said the exact opposite.
Oh, dear.
John Henry actually said the exact opposite about the Galileo affair. John Henry's work actually says, look, the Galileo affair is not a quintessential example of science and religion in conflict. We know that. Here's all the data. And yet they were citing John Henry and saying, essentially, the Galileo affair was a quintessential example of science and religion being in conflict. And so it really, I think, is a problem of the academics themselves not being willing to throw off that myth that has become such a powerful element of the world around us.
So what's the solution?
That's a good question. I think part of the solution is those that have been studying the data. So we have sociologists that have actually been looking at, let's say, scientific belief or the acceptance of scientific ideas and religious beliefs, and found, look, it's much more complicated than we know internationally. It's much more complicated than, oh, look, a society becomes scientific and then it becomes less religious. And then the historians who have for decades now been trying to push this forward, that we just, these academics need to be continuing to push this forward, but not just to the public. I think there have been a lot of really excellent concerted efforts to push, to kind of disseminate these academic ideas to the through the popular media and to citizens via books. But at the same time, it's not just the popular message that needs to get out. Academics that are working in these fields need to be trying to get this message to other academics.
Sounds like you guys need to talk to each other.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. Tom Eckner is an academic who works on science and religion, which means he's devoted a lot of time and energy to understanding certain bones of contention in what sometimes get called the culture wars. He's interested in why things become cultural flashpoints, like evolution or vaccines or climate change. And he insists that whether we're talking about where these clashes come from or how we can resolve them, things aren't as black and white as we might imagine.
A lot of my work has actually not been wrapped up in studying textbooks. That's a side project. That's just a side project of mine that came about with talking to students.
It's just a bit of fun.
My work has really been dealing with why it is that what we might call the evolution wars or continued religiously motivated antagonism towards evolutionary theory has continued, despite the fact that we get philosophers and an abundant number of theologians, historians, religious leaders that have said, look, there doesn't have to be a conflict between evolutionary theory and, let's say, Christian scriptures. I've been looking at that problem about why these evolution wars have continued, and part of my answer has been looking at things like very persuasive mass media, and ideas of cultural cognition. But at the same time, the people that are opposed to evolutionary theory wouldn't say that they're opposed to science. A lot of the sociological data on this would say that actually people that would be opposed to science, let's say for religious reasons, so let's say for they believe that the book of Genesis is a literal historical text and must be analyzed as such, they would say, well, look, I'm not opposed to physics. I'm not opposed to much of science, much of what happens in labs. So I think that we have to be a little bit sensitive to that. But there are Christians that are definitely opposed to certain aspects of science because it seems to oppose a literal or more literal young earth perception of the universe, which they get from reading Genesis 1 through 11.
So this is a broader issue, right, than simply a matter of Christians reading their Bible and going, no, I think there are things in here that disagree with a scientific account of where humans came from and where the universe came from.
Yeah, I would say that that's true. Even from the very beginning, in terms of, let's say, specifically Christian resistance to evolutionary theory, or also in the Islamic world, historically, Islamic resistance to evolutionary theory wasn't necessarily bound to people just reading Genesis and saying this is in opposition to evolutionary theory. So a lot of the original, let's say, early 20th century, for instance, opposition to evolutionary theory that we see in the United States, for instance, came about because evolution seemed to be supporting racist ideas, and there was moral opposition to the idea that we were going to reduce people down to evolutionary levels, and then using sort of the scientific premise of evolution, we could actually rank people evolutionarily. And so evolution was actually wrapped up with a lot of this discourse. So Christians were opposed in many ways morally to evolution because of what it seemed to be saying. So some of the textbooks in the United States, for instance, that were teaching evolution in such a way that said that I read actually sections of these textbooks to my students that say, okay, look, evolutionarily, Caucasians are the most advanced of the human race, and then we go down the ranks. You know, at the very bottom, we get black people. You know, they're the most primitive. And that was wrapped up in teaching of evolution. So Christians were actually opposed to evolutionary theory, not by simply looking at the Bible and saying, okay, this is the Genesis account of creation. A lot of the people were actually less literal about Genesis even at that time. But they were seeing that the science of evolution was being wrapped up into this whole kind of social Darwin narrative and quite racist descriptions of human beings, and they opposed it on those grounds. By the mid-20th century, we actually see kind of young earth creationist ideas on the decline. So, in fact, in the 1960s, we see people saying, this is the end of the monkey war. We're not really seeing this opposition to evolutionary theory. But then in the 1960s, we also see the publication of a book by Whitcomb and John Morris called The Genesis Flood. And this really sort of repackaged young earth creationism in kind of more scientific terms. And it got really well picked up in evangelical communities in the United States. And this really has been seen to have been one of the sparks of kind of reigniting what we would call a young earth creationist movement in opposition to evolutionary theory. And that really got kind of wrapped up also in the politicization of science, where certain kind of religious political positions were wrapped up in the culture wars of the United States. And they kind of became identity markers in some ways. So if you were, let's say, a supporter of a certain political party, and you were also a member of a certain religious, a Christian denomination, then you were opposed to evolutionary theory. It all got wrapped up. There was a political element, and there was a cultural element, and then there was that initial spark from John C. Whitcomb and Morris's work. And that really fueled kind of what has been called a renaissance of young earth creationism in the 20th century.
What's the way forward then, do you think, on these kind of culture wars?
Well, I think that something that has not helped is just continuing to point fingers at people. And so we get people on both sides of this debate really making some significant accusations. And so let's just say from quite popular atheist writers, there's this idea that effectively religion diminishes human value by reducing our human rationality and reason. And as a result, that's what causes people to be violent to each other, and it's an affront to humanity. It's religion that leads directly to violence, these sorts of ideas. And again, we know that these sorts of extreme claims are just not true. We see positive attributes of religion throughout human history, in fact, in promoting science. On the other side, we get people that are really opposed to certain attributes of science, let's say evolution again, really making pretty strong claims that if we accept evolutionary theory, that has led to mass violence and will continue to lead to mass violence. And both of these ideas are quite extreme, and it would be difficult to not find more complexity. So I think part of the problem is, let's just say with anti-evolutionists, people just saying anti-evolutionists are ignorant and that they're stupid. I think that's not helping. It doesn't help because, in fact, people that may be anti-evolutionists, I don't think there's necessarily a correlation between intelligence and being an anti-evolutionist. I think there's much more going on. There are social realities, people accepting anti-evolutionism for moral reasons or perceived moral reasons because people in their community have been anti-evolutionists. And it's not necessarily simply a problem of ignorance. And accepting the fact that it's much more complicated than that will help us approach dealing with these issues than just pointing fingers and essentially yelling at each other.
It's a principle that works across a range of issues, really. Accepting that things are complicated instead of pointing fingers and yelling at each other. So is there a better way? It's a pertinent question, especially for governments and for educators. How does mass persuasion work? How can we have public conversations where people might actually consider changing their minds on an issue?
I think a number of policies and that governments have implemented are still working primarily on the idea that the problem is one of knowledge deficits. So the reason why people are not accepting vaccines is because they just don't have enough knowledge. Again, they're ignorant of the history of the success of vaccines and these sorts of ideas. And so if we just increase the amount of data that is out there, the amount of facts that are out there, eventually people will come around. And what most modern research in this area has demonstrated is that this just isn't the case. So there's a researcher, for instance, from the University of Yale named Dan Kahan, and one of the things that he studied was looking at different denials of scientific claims. And what he, instead of just looking at what people are saying, he said, well, let's first ask them what they know about the science itself, and then we'll ask them their perspective. And so, for instance, with climate change denial, he looked at what do people that are opposed to climate change know about climate change, and what do people that are supportive of the idea that, look, climate change is occurring and it's human-caused, what do they say? And he actually found that the amount of knowledge that both parties had about climate change was almost equal. In some cases, for instance, people that were opposed to climate change actually seemed to have a better understanding than at least of what scientists were saying because they were looking into it. And then he looked at their perceptions and he found that the people that were climate change deniers were for probably other reasons. And that it had to do with what he calls identity protective reasoning. Their identities were wrapped up in socio-religious political identities in which climate change was denied. So it had nothing to do with the knowledge of climate change or what the scientists were saying about climate change. That was about equal. And we find that with other attributes, it might be even be the case with vaccines. So it's not just simply about trying to get facts across, because people often know those facts and still deny it because they identify with a movement or a group or a community that is against it. So I think in terms of just initial research in this area, a better way to approach, let's say, increasing vaccination rates isn't just, to say, look, these people just are ignorant and try to increase facts. Always try to spread facts. I always try to do that. But also appeal to the values of those people. You know, what do they value? What is it about their identities that they value and that is wrapped up in opposition to vaccines? And try to address that. Try to have more of a positive approach to it in acknowledging their concerns within the communities that they're part of and addressing vaccines in relation to that, rather than just keep throwing out facts.
Presumably, lots and lots, if not most people who accept climate change, who accept vaccines, they also believe those things for, you know, social reasons and to do with the cultures that they're in and not because, you know, science.
That's exactly the case. So because the knowledge levels are often exactly the same in terms of the populations that are for, let's say, vaccines or accept climate change, as to those that are against climate change and might be in opposition to climate change, the knowledge is often quite similar. We know that that's not the differential, or that's not necessarily the concern. And so both sides then are making decisions on what we would call cultural cognitive grounds. They're making decisions based on the culture in which they exist and which they thrive. And the point there is that that's not necessarily illogical. So often people just say that our anti-vaxxers are called, irrational, and there is an irrationality there in terms of the data. We know that. But at the same time, the decision to make to be, let's say, an anti-vaxxer because everyone in your family has been an anti-vaxxer, maybe everyone in your religious community has been an anti-vaxxer, maybe everyone of the parents that you're friends with are anti-vaxxers. In some ways, it would be, people have said, it might be actually socially illogical to go against them. So on certain decisions, it's not necessarily, again, whether you're for or against, let's say, vaccines or climate change, or human-caused climate change, it's not necessarily down to facts. It's that social, cultural, cognitive basis that a lot of us make a lot of our decisions.
A lot of these issues, discussion of them gets very heated, obviously. Disagreeing well on things we feel strongly about is not something we're always great at. Are there things that you can recommend, things that work well for you in terms of having these conversations with people you disagree with?
Well, that's a very good question. And part of the reason that these things get heated is because these questions of whether evolution is true or not for some people, or whether climate change is happening or not. The reason that people react strongly to those opinions is not just because of the scientific validity or invalidity of those things, or lack of validity of those things. It's because they are wrapped up in values. They are wrapped up in personal values. The way that they view, let's say, religious scripture is wrapped up in that. And that's a very significant question. The way questions about how to raise your children are wrapped up into those questions. They're not just scientific issues for people. And that's one thing you have to recognize. So I think if you're going to get into a conversation with people, is that you're not just dealing with facts and you're not just dealing with scientific, you're dealing with values that people hold very closely to their hearts. Whether you agree with those values or not, I'm not saying that that's a valid reason or an invalid reason to accept or reject a scientific premise, but that's just the reality. And those values are then tied to the communities that those people are part of. So I think you start with accepting that, but also I think that it helps to ask questions. Ask questions rather than just saying, look, here are the facts. You are wrong about vaccines. Ask questions about why they have this view of vaccines. Where do they get these ideas from? And go from there. At the same time, for instance, one of the things that I found in terms of, let's say, those that are trying to promote vaccine hesitancies in populations, one of the things that's fundamental to the messages of people that we might call anti-vaxxers or people that are trying to promote vaccine hesitancies are narratives. There was a mom, and this is what happened, and now she has a child with autism. And those narratives are very, very powerful. And often those narratives are more powerful than just me spouting off facts. So try to get down to those narratives. And if you have narratives of your own, start to engage with those narratives. So ask questions, engage in narratives that also relate to the values of the people that you're dealing with.
You've been listening to Life and Faith. I'm Natasha Moore. If you enjoyed this conversation with Tom Eckner, we've got plenty more on science and religion, and also on disagreeing well about contentious issues, on our website, publicchristianity.org. And of course, there's a new conversation on Life and Faith each week. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week.
When I was young, my father would take me to the movies, but he had this weird habit of not looking to when the movie started. So more times than not, we'd show up like
Having 20 minutes
before the movie's over, like a good James Bond movie. So he'd watch the last 20 minutes and then he'd say, okay, we'll wait and watch the beginning. And then when we come to the end where we came, he goes, okay, we've seen this, let's go home. And that's kind of like reading the New Testament without the Old Testament. But a lot of people don't even watch the first part on the next showing.